Okay, good morning, everyone. Today we're going to be looking at the biography of quite a controversial figure, actually. His name is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Now, most of this story takes place in Germany in World War II, but we're going to begin in 1906 in February. Dietrich and his twin sister, Sabine, were born into a very illustrious family, a very highly cultured family in Germany. Now, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's father was actually a really famous professor of psychiatry and neurology. He was a director at a hospital. He was also a professor at the university. And his mother as well was a very, very educated woman, particularly in that day. You know, she had a university degree, which was so unusual for women in that time. And she came from a family of very eminent theologians. In fact, her grandfather was actually a famous church historian by the name of Karl von Haas. So you can imagine, Dietrich and Sabine and the other six children in the household had a very privileged and educated upbringing in these early years. Now, they had a wonderful little holiday house on the Bohemian border near the Glatz Mountains. And they would spend their summertime there romping through meadows and running through the woods and things like that. And, you know, this was the most idyllic childhood you could ever imagine for these children. And the Bonhoeffers really ensured that their children had a really good education as well. So, you know, they were schooled in their younger years by Paula, their mother, and she also made sure that she was going to really instill in them good theology, good religious education, and proper Christian values. And she really expected them to live these out with great resolution. But actually, the family was not a Christian family. In fact, Karl Bonhoeffer, the father of the house, he wouldn't even have called himself a Christian. He respected the values. He was happy for his wife to teach the children the Bible, but he himself didn't believe it. And they, as a family, rarely went to church. You know, they rarely attended meetings and things like that. However, the children also had some governesses and nannies who were believers. And so actually, the children grew up with a good sort of founding in the scripture, based on their mother's education and also the influence of their nannies. Dietrich himself had a really inquisitive mind. At the age of four, when they sat down for lunch one day, he actually turned to his mother and said, "Does God too sit down for lunch?" And he and his twin sister Sabine, they used to play these strange bedtime games where they would lie down in bed and try and envision eternity. And the first person to go to sleep was the loser. Now, once at school, all the Bonhoeffer children absolutely excelled. But they were also surrounded by a really unique group of people. They'd moved to Berlin, and now the neighbourhood that they lived in was a hugely affluent area. They had a house with grounds and gardens, and they played with children of various professors and historians and such like. So it was a very unusual upbringing in a way. When Bonhoeffer was 8 years old, World War I hit, and Germany was embroiled in this war. At that very moment, actually, they were on holiday in their holiday house on the Bohemian border and their property there. And their nannies quickly bundled them, all the children, into the train and took them back home to be with the parents. And the older children actually ran into the house, and they were yelling, "Hurrah, there's war!" But of course they were promptly slapped for that. But that was the feeling of the day, the idea that this war would be an opportunity for Germany, that it was something noble and patriotic about it all. The two older children were soon called up for service. And in 1918, Walter Bonhoeffer was hit by an exploding shell. He was quite badly injured, and he actually died of his injuries. And this was a huge shock to the Bonhoeffer family, particularly Paula Bonhoeffer, the mother of the family. And we know it certainly impacted Dietrich a lot as well. He actually kept Walter's Bible for the rest of his life. And you know, the family realized that they could have pulled strings and used their various contacts to actually, you know, maybe ensure that their sons weren't conscripted, but they didn't. And they were really, the tragedy of this really impacted the whole family. And perhaps for Dietrich, his pacifist ideals stemmed from this traumatic experience. Now, when World War I was over, Germany suffered a terrible, terrible defeat. It was quite a horrendous defeat, in fact, and it crushed the nation. And then to top it off, that Treaty of Versailles was not only humiliating and it was also very harsh. And the country as a whole really felt in some way, I guess that they felt so humiliated by this defeat. And I guess people were looking around for someone to blame. You know, in some cases they felt that perhaps the communists had stabbed them in the back or something like that. Or we know that the Kaiser stepped down. There was a lot of political unrest and also economic turmoil as part of all the after effects of the war. In fact, Dietrich was at school and he wrote a letter to his parents saying, "Could you please send more money because I've just had to spend 6 billion marks on a loaf of bread." By the age of 15, Bonhoeffer was sure that he wanted to be a theologian. Now, his family had provided this full education in language, in the literature, in the arts. In fact, Bonhoeffer himself was a really good pianist, and his parents actually thought that he would pursue a musical career. But he wanted to do theology, and he was so clear that he wanted to do theology. And his parents even made him play in front of a concert pianist who was in Berlin at the time, a man by the name of Kreutzer. But, you know, Kreutzer wasn't particularly conclusive with his, you know, with Dietrich's talents and whether he would make it as a concert pianist. And so in the end, the parents decided this, we're just, whatever Dietrich wants to do, he will do. Now, the reason he wanted to do theology wasn't because he had a real experience, a personal experience of the Lord at this point. For theology in this day and age was a very academic choice. It was sort of on par with law, and particularly in Berlin, which was seen as sort of one of the world's best places to study theology. But around this time, Dietrich actually attended an evangelical meeting where Bramwell Booth, the son of William Booth, who started the Salvation Army, was speaking. And he wrote to and spoke to his sister about how he'd seen this joy in people's faces as they were converted. And this was the first time that Bonhoeffer had encountered this. Previously, theology was like a philosophy. It was interesting. But he'd seen some sort of reality in people's lives that he hadn't witnessed before. Dietrich started university at the age of 17, and he was, as the tradition in the family, he started with 1 year at Tübingen University. All his siblings were there. His father had started there as well. And these were really wonderful times of learning for this insatiable mind. But soon he was transferred to Berlin University, where he continued his study in theology. And he worked under really eminent theologians who were world-renowned, people like von Harnack, Reinhold Seeberg, and then later on he was also the favourite student of the Swiss theologian Karl Barth. Now, during this time, he had a staggering workload, and he really showed his capability. You know, he was doing his doctoral dissertation, but he also was taking on Sunday school classes, which were more educational in those days. And he ended up not just having one class, but all the classes combined. And then he also selected certain young men who he felt showed some sort of extra promise or interest in learning. And he created what he called the Thursday Circle for extra teaching and discussion. And all of this experience at this time at university made him think that perhaps an academic theological pursuit wasn't perhaps where he was headed, and perhaps it was more the job of a pastor. Well, his parents were absolutely horrified at this idea. They knew that their son was gifted intellectually, and they didn't want him wasting away in some remote parish somewhere. At the age of 21, he had completed his dissertation, which is our equivalent of a PhD, but he was still far too young to be ordained. And so he continued his academic work, and he completed a second one. But then, at the age of 24, he still had a year to go before being ordained. And so he got himself a fellowship to go and study for 1 year at the New York Union Theological Seminary. This was really an opportunity of a lifetime. But actually, as Bonhoeffer arrived on the shores of New York, he had no idea what was happening in Germany at that time. Of course, news didn't travel very quickly. But when he arrived at New York, the German elections were in motion. And actually, the results of these elections were really shocking. You see, there was this tiny party with 12 members. And in this election, they won so many seats, they became the second largest party of the nation. And this political party was led by a man called Adolf Hitler. Now, Bonhoeffer knew nothing of the changes in Germany. As he stepped off the boat into New York, it was the jazz age that he walked into, the complete opposite of everything that he had experienced in Berlin. You know, Berlin was famous for its conservative tradition. It was an intellectual stronghold. And, you know, I think Bonhoeffer was a little arrogant when he stepped off and he was introduced to the theological college. He really felt that he should be teaching there rather than sitting there as a student. He had sat under von Harnack, who was world-renowned, and he had little respect for the theology that was being taught in this New York Bible College. In fact, he wrote, "In New York, they preach virtually everything. Only one thing is not addressed, the gospel of Jesus Christ, the cross, sin, forgiveness, death and life." However, despite this, and despite his initial, perhaps a little arrogance, this was actually a turning point in Bonhoeffer's life. And thank God for this, and also thank God for perhaps a little bit of humour here, because Bonhoeffer came feeling so superior academically. But his life was changed when one of his fellow students, a man by the name of Frank Fisher, who was an African-American, introduced him to his church, an African-American church in Harlem in New York. And here there were 14,000 African-Americans gathering together. And Dietrich was so impacted by their simplicity, their genuine joy, and also he heard the gospel preached in such a simple way for the first time. And he attended this church regularly, and he got to know the people, and in fact, he was quite noticeable with his blonde hair and blue eyes amidst that congregation. And he ended up really loving the music. He bought records of all the Negro spirituals, and he brought them back home with him. And there was something that happened during that time. We don't know exactly what, but there was something that happened where he saw the reality of converted lives. And the interesting thing was, at that time, because of the racial issues in America, you know, Bonhoeffer was also very impacted by that. And he saw the terrible injustices of the day, and he saw how these African Americans were so unfairly treated and all the segregation. He actually wrote to his brother and said, you know, it is unbelievable to see this racial prejudice. And he said, you know, we have nothing like this in Germany. There is nothing to compare. A little bit ironic, considering what the next few years would hold. When Bonhoeffer returned to Berlin, he started lecturing straight away. And the other thing was, he started attending a church, and he also started taking communion. This was something he hadn't done before. In fact, his family noticed a significant change in him. they couldn't put their finger on it. I mean, he was always interested in theology and philosophy and so on, but there was something different about their son. Even his students noticed a difference. You know, previously he would lecture them, but now he didn't just want to teach them. He wanted to disciple them. He called them to ask questions so that they would be able to know God. At 12 noon, on January the 30th, 1933, Hitler became the Chancellor of Germany, and this was the beginning of the Third Reich. On this very same day, Bonhoeffer was due to give a speech at a radio station, and his topic, interestingly, was on the fundamental problems of the concept of Führer. And it was interesting that he had written this before Adolf Hitler's rise to power. But he had already felt that there was something wrong, that this idea of this leader who has total control, he wrote that this would mislead, or he would be a misleader to the German people. Unfortunately, their speech was cut short. Now, we don't know if that was because of Nazi censorship or if it was simply just the radio station that just cut it off, or even just a technological glitch, or who knows what it was. But the timing of this speech was really interesting because Bonhoeffer was the first person to speak out against Adolf Hitler. And perhaps there was something prophetic in this speech. But no one in Germany could ever guess the extent and fierceness of the changes that were about to happen. Because right at this point, Hitler was actually really, really popular, and people were throwing their support behind this person who was resurrecting the German nation and restoring great pride. Christel Bonhoeffer, Dietrich's older sister, had married a lawyer by the name of Hans von Dohnanyi. And Hans von Dohnanyi was actually a really famous lawyer. He was operated in the High Court. And so he was privy to a lot of secret information. And he had heard about this thing called the Aryan paragraph. The idea that Hitler believed in the Germanic race, you know, the blonde hair, blue eyes, and that they were superior. And he had plans to throw out all Jewish members of government and people in public service and things like that. And, you know, when Hans von Dohnanyi shared this with the Bonhoeffer family, they actually couldn't believe it. You know, the civilized, highly educated nation, and particularly Berlin, you know, would anyone really accept this? At this early point in Hitler's reign, Dietrich actually wrote an essay because he already knew that Hitler was going to move to try and get rid of all Jews from the churches, all the clergy, all the theologians, and so on. And he wrote this essay with great clarity and urgency, urging the other leaders of various churches to stand up against this. But the urgency was missed, and many people just ignored what Bonhoeffer was saying. And soon, of course, Hitler did roll out plans, and pastors, ministers, church leaders all over Germany were expelled from churches if they had any Jewish blood. And soon there were posters around the streets that said things like, Germans, protect yourselves, don't buy from Jews. And actually, at this point, people were responding favorably. This fear campaign was really working. Meanwhile, Dietrich's twin sister Sabine had recently married a lawyer who was Jewish. His name was Gerhard Liebholz. And he was actually lecturing at a university. And suddenly, you know, well, one day he turned up and the SA, the police or the Nazi police, were in front of the lecture hall and were turning people away. And soon he was not able to lecture, and a week later he'd lost his position just because of his Jewish blood. Soon Sabine noticed that when they walked down the street, people were crossing over to the other side, not wanting to share the footpath with a Jew. And this was really shocking at just the speed at which that happened and the changes occurred. But even then, you know, there were some colleagues and friends who came and spoke to Liebholz and said, "Sir, I am ashamed to be called a German." But in a few months, all Jews were expelled or not allowed to attend entertainment venues or cultural events or any activity like that. Soon all Jews were expelled from journalism and the media. And it's really unbelievable in retrospect, but people supported this. In fact, you know, at a university, they arranged a rally, which they called the Rally Against the Un-German Spirit. And in this rally, they gathered up all the books by Jewish authors and thinkers, writers, and they burned them in a symbolic gesture of cleansing Germany. And in that pile of books were books written by H.G. Wells, Helen Keller, Sigmund Freud, and of course Albert Einstein. Hitler himself did not believe in God, and he was hugely cynical of the church and its leaders. He once said that Christianity was a meek and flabby religion. He hated the weakness that it promoted, as he put it. And in fact, you know, he would say that if you get all the clergy, all the church leaders in a room, and you just ask one question, you will watch them shrink and shrivel in embarrassment. That's how Hitler thought. But in 1930, in Germany at that time, 100% of the population was Christian of some sort. Or nominal, perhaps, but they would have said that they were Christian. And so Hitler had to tread carefully. On Hitler's side, though, there were many other leaders, like Himmler, who was the head of the SS, who also really had an agenda to destroy Christianity, to rid the country of this, and to ensure that the Nazis had total control over everything, including the churches. In the 1920s, there was this subtle movement called the German Church. And these were called the so-called German Christians who, I guess, it came out of the defeat of World War I and the humiliation. But these were people who were more nationalistic. And Hitler used this and saw an opportunity here. And so he sort of offered his support to this German church, as it was soon called. And if we have a look at this, you know, I think this can be a lesson for all of us. But so many Christians didn't even notice the subtle changes. And in fact, there were many leaders, theologians, etc., leading Christian speakers who were throwing themselves behind this new German church movement. And Hitler did this quite subtly, but soon, you know, after all the Jewish pastors and ministers were expelled, you know, they started to talk about how the Bible itself wasn't really from God, and actually the Old Testament needed to be removed. Soon they were removing parts of the New Testament as well. And you know, the leader that they appointed as head of the German church, he actually stated that the voice of God is the voice of the people. And they completely changed all the doctrine. In fact, Hitler wanted to promote what he called a positive Christianity. Away with the negatives, they would say. Away with a focus on sin and the death of Christ. We want to focus on liberty, purification. And that is exactly what they taught. And in fact, you know, they actually taught that God had chosen the Aryan people, and their true savior was Adolf Hitler. Nominal Christians were swept along. Christians who were totally asleep were swept along with all of these changes. And there were very few people who stood against this tidal wave that was washing over Germany. Bonhoeffer was one of the few people who recognized this immediately for what it was. And he resisted these changes. And it wasn't only him. He was also joined by a man called Martin Niemöller. And Niemöller was the head of a resistance movement. He really wanted to stop Hitler from taking control over the churches and then having a say on everything that was done within those buildings. And so they started this thing called the Pastors' Emergency League. And they wanted people to join together and support the Jews that had been expelled from their position. In fact, Bonhoeffer had tried to organize a general strike for all clergy to stand down, just to stand with their brothers and sisters who had been impacted by Hitler's laws. But people didn't want to do it. And so it didn't happen. But with this Pastors' Emergency League, with Niemöller as well, they managed to get 6,000 people to sign up, which shows that there were people in Germany who were really aware of the changes that were happening, but perhaps weren't brave enough to stand up on their own. This became known as the Confessing Church, and they tried to work to ensure that the truth of the gospel was still taught. But Hitler had a plan and a clear agenda. And soon he was not just impacting the churches, but he was ensuring that all theological colleges, Bible colleges, seminaries, all of those types of places, schools, were teaching the German church doctrine, that positive Christianity. And all other Bible colleges were completely illegal. Now, this is actually when the Confessing Church realized they really had to act. And so they decided that they would make their own little Bible colleges hidden away in remote areas across the nation. They wanted to ensure that the truth of the gospel was still taught, that people, the next generation, would even know what a Christian was. That was their concern. Bonhoeffer at this point was actually in London at that time, ministering in a German congregation there. But he was called back to lead up a seminary. And he was placed in a place called Finkenwalde. And this particular area was on the Pomeranian border. You know, it was quite a remote area in a small village. And it was an old schoolhouse where he would have students who would come and, yes, illegally, be taught. And then they would go on become pastors and so on. Now, Bonhoeffer really relished this opportunity. Despite all the political unrest and all the issues that were happening around in Germany at the time, he really loved this opportunity to disciple young men to become leaders of the day. Now, interestingly, he was only 29 at this point, so he himself was very, very young. And it was a very hard job because really they had no resources, and being illegal, they had to really keep their heads down. But the village of Finkenwalde was so very supportive. They didn't like Hitler, and so they threw their support behind Pastor Bonhoeffer and his young men. In fact, one day, one of the farmers came because food was hard to find, and Bonhoeffer woke to find a pig tied onto the front door with a little tag in its ear reading, "To Pastor Bonhoeffer." 23 students started for that first session. Bonhoeffer was so touched by Jesus' Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And for him, this was the key to how Christians need to live and how they need to live together. And he wrote two books that came out of the learning from this time. He wrote The Cost of Discipleship and also Life Together, these two books. He actually wrote as well, When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. And that's how he really felt, that if we are serious about living for the Lord in every aspect, then everything must be for him. You know, your intellect, reputation, you must be willing to give your career, all your desires, your ideals, everything for him. And that's how he taught these students at Finkenwalde. Now, he taught through lectures and preaching in the usual ways. There was often lively discussion. But he also taught them really strict personal discipline. And he felt that this was really important as well. And, you know, for him, and he wrote in Life Together, it is a privilege but not even just a privilege, it's a necessity for Christians to live together in community. And for him, he said, you know, living together is living in and through Jesus Christ. That's the only way. But his focus on this personal discipline and how it's part of everyday life received a lot of criticism. In fact, his former teacher, Karl Barth, you know, said to him, you're not running a monastery. You are running a Bible college here, a seminary. But for Dietrich, he really believed. He believed in responsible, and this is, I quote, responsible, obedient action in concrete everyday life, in private and in public. So the students were really responsible for the running of the place as well. And in fact, one student recalls how he rolled out of bed one morning and rushed to the morning devotions. And then he came back mid-morning and he actually found Pastor Bonhoeffer making his bed. It's very embarrassing. But that was the detail to which they were taught, that they needed to get their lives right as well. Now, Bonhoeffer really wanted to instill these young men with the truth of the gospel so that they would then go on to make disciples. He felt the urgency of this, considering the time in which they were living and the fact that all the churches were compromising around like the entire nation. And so many people had now actually believed that this Nazification of the gospel was the gospel. And he wanted to ensure that that wasn't the case. He wanted these people to go out and make more disciples. Here as well, in this first group of students, Bonhoeffer met his best friend, who would be his confidant and also the person who would keep and later publish all his letters and writings. His name was Eberhard Bethge, and he became a very probably the closest friend to Bonhoeffer. In 2 years, the Gestapo found out about all these illegal seminaries, and they were all closed down. But about 100 students had passed through those walls during that time. And little did anyone know at that point how few of them would actually go on to be pastors. More than half of Bonhoeffer's little flock there were killed in World War II or imprisoned and killed in concentration camps. And others of them, the ministering they did was on a front line, on a battlefield. In the middle of the night, in November of 1938, Hitler ordered the SS, gave the command for them to go through Germany and target Jews. It was retribution and revenge, but it was also an opportunity. The SS ran through the streets of Berlin and all the streets of the various big cities of Germany, smashing Jewish businesses, dragging people out of their homes, Jews and their families, and killing and beating people. Synagogues were burnt, houses were burnt. It was unthinkable what occurred that night. This perhaps began the next chapter of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life. This had a huge impact on him, and he had this inner restlessness, what some people called perhaps holy anger. He marked in his Bible that day and a particular psalm, and he wrote that, you know, to touch God's people is to defy God, to shake your fist at God, to touch God. And how could he let this happen and stand by? Well, war was mounting, and already Germany had invaded parts of Europe, and everyone knew that they were on the brink of war. This, of course, also meant that in Germany, conscription was already happening, and Bonhoeffer, now at just 30 years old, knew that he would be conscripted, and they had information that he definitely would be called up. Now, again, the family sprang into action. Dietrich himself knew that he did not want to fight in Hitler's war. He knew more than most people about what was going on, and he refused to fight. So his family sprang into action this time. And they contacted various people they knew. They knew so many people across Europe. And they managed to get him a position in New York to work there amongst the German refugees and also to do some teaching and so on. This was almost a position that was made for him. And the paperwork was done very quickly. A week before he was called to the army, everything had been finalized. And when, of course, he was called up, he was able just to hand over the paperwork, and he was excused. In June 1939, he arrived in New York again. And he got off that ship, and he realized he had made a terrible mistake. This was not where he needed to be right now. He had no peace at all. In some ways, you know, when we thought about the whole situation, it seemed that the Lord had orchestrated this, that it had all happened so smoothly. He'd managed to get this position, and he was out of there. He was going to escape the war entirely, and he wouldn't be needing to fight in Hitler's war. But he had no peace whatsoever. And as day passed into day, he felt with this great clarity that he was wasting his time and that every day that passed, it was a lost opportunity. And he knew that he needed to get back to Germany. The people were quite shocked at this, and they thought, you've just escaped. You don't want to take the next ship back. But that's exactly what he wanted to do. He felt that if he could not be there amidst the trials and be there with the brothers and sisters who were struggling through this time, then he had no right to be there afterwards to rebuild. He wanted to be there. And so he returned just after 26 days. Now back in Germany, it wasn't long before World War II was declared. And already Hans von Dohnanyi had discovered so much of the atrocities that were happening in Germany at that time, not only in Germany, but also in parts of Europe. Hans von Dohnanyi, brother-in-law of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, working there in the High Court, was privy to a huge amount of information. He knew about the atrocities that were being committed in Poland against the Jews. He realized that the Jews were being targeted to the point of perhaps even exterminated. That was the word that was being used. And not only that, but he had heard about this euthanasia program that Hitler was just about to roll out. It was a program that meant that midwives would have to kill any baby born with a birth defect or a disability. In a few years, 5,000 babies were killed. And Hans von Dohnanyi actually started a secret file. He wanted to ensure that these people were brought to justice in the end, when all of this was over. And so although it was extremely risky, he collated evidence of all of these things. And this he called the Chronicle of Shame. And later it became known as the Zosen Files. But it was at this juncture in Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life that he realized that he was already embroiled in so much conspiracy. Not only through his brother-in-law and through the fact that he was privy to all this secret information, but also the fact that he was already supporting other family members and other people that he knew who were working in the inner circle, but they were working against Hitler. They were known as the resistance. He had been supporting these people. He knew what was going on. And it's also at this point that many people feel there are contradictions in Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life. You know, how could a man who is so clear on living God's way, who wants to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, how can a man like that throw himself behind plots and schemes and this was what their schemes were about, to assassinate Hitler and to bring down the Nazi Party and thereby ending the war? How could he throw himself behind that and truly support that? Was that the godly thing to do? Now, Bonhoeffer himself really, really struggled with this. You know, he really thought through this because it wasn't easy for him. And he wrote, "If I sit next to a madman as he drives his car into a group of innocent bystanders. I can't, as a Christian, simply wait for the catastrophe and then comfort the wounded and bury the dead. I must try to wrestle the steering wheel out of the hands of that driver. Bonhoeffer knew that he was in a very unique position. He was in that passenger seat, so close to the driver. And he really did feel that he had a certain duty to his nation, the people, the believers, and also to God's people, the Jews. He knew more than anybody at that time, he knew more than the average person about what Hitler was doing. He knew about the concentration camps and the gas chambers. He knew about what was happening with people with disabilities. And he felt that there was no way in clear conscience he could remain inactive. We don't know if he said this. We don't know if this quote was from him. It's sometimes attributed to him. But he said, silence in the face of evil is evil itself, and not to act is to act. Not to speak is to speak. And things were changing very quickly. A church gathering he was speaking at, where he was invited to speak, was broken up. Niemela himself had refused to sign his unconditional allegiance to Hitler, and so he had been, his phone had been tapped, he'd been followed, his house had been searched, and he'd been taken away to a concentration camp. Dietrich Bonhoeffer himself was now forbidden to travel, preach, speak, write, and he knew that he would inevitably be called up for service. Now, this was when his brother-in-law, Hans von Donnany, spotted a possible solution. Already, von Donnany was working for the Abwehr. The Abwehr was the German military intelligence. It was like the Gestapo, just like the FBI is like the CIA, but they were quite separate. And so this, in the Abwehr, they didn't really associate with the Gestapo, and the Gestapo really didn't associate with the Abwehr, so you could be kind of safe there. And of course, he wouldn't be called up for service. Now, the thought was that Bonhoeffer could be a civilian, could be employed by the Abwehr as a civilian spy. And in this role, they also wanted him to operate as a double agent. So, you know, he would have a front. His front was actually true. I mean, he was going to be a pastor. And he would, through the Abwehr, be able to travel through Europe. Now, the official position was that he was gathering information about what the Allies were doing and bringing it back to Germany for military intelligence. But actually, what he would be doing was going to Europe to give them information, acting as couriers, to support the assassination plot of Hitler and to ensure that the Allies were able to support them in doing this and in also informing a new government quickly afterwards. So his role as a courier meant that he would be travelling, he would be able to pass to people. He also would be able, therefore, to visit so many of the students that were scattered all over the nation and to ensure that he could continue discipling them in whatever way he could. He talked about this with his family and Eberhard Bethke, his good friend, and they felt it was a good option. And so he took this position. He was now a double agent for the Abwehr. Now, this was a very, very lonely place for Bonhoeffer. You see, many people on the outside, people who were close enough to even know that he'd joined the Abwehr, they thought that he'd compromised, that he'd somehow changed sides. They wondered if he'd left his faith. And then other people, you know, they were just so disappointed that he was not signing up for military service, that he was not patriotic and supporting the nation. And so he had criticism from every side. In fact, even his former teacher, Karl Barth, was shocked and disappointed in his former pupil. But, of course, he couldn't put any of them straight, and he just had to continue on. The speed of World War II was unbelievable, and many people who were close to Hitler, the generals and so on, saw the huge conceit of Hitler, his incredible self-belief as well. And many people actually felt, the people who were close in, felt that Hitler was mad. And the things that he wanted to do and achieve were just unthinkable. But then they saw the speed at which the war had taken off and the initial successes of Germany. But there were many generals who knew that Hitler would ultimately bring the country down. The first assassination plot was in 1943. This was known as Operation Flash, and it was something that, although Bonhoeffer wasn't directly involved, he had been involved in currying information. The Gestapo had already started to get suspicious of the Abwehr at this time, but at this point, they knew that they had a chance to act. Hitler was going to be taking a chartered flight from one city to another, and one of the generals had a general who was actually a double agent. He had a bottle of brandy, very expensive brandy, that he was going to give as a gift. And in this bottle of brandy, it's beautiful casing and so on, but in the bottle itself there was a bomb. And he handed this case over to another general, who then, of course, took it. They were used to receiving gifts, and they put it in the luggage carrier of this small aircraft. Hitler and his closest men boarded the airline, and they flew. The resistance knew that the bomb had a 30-minute detonator, so they had already calculated exactly where the plane would be when it would explode. They had already put plans into action. They knew that they would be able to come in quickly, form an interim government. All these plans were already ready to be enacted. But the plane landed safely, and they realized that bomb had failed to detonate. And now they had another problem. They needed to get that bomb off the plane, because if anyone found it, of course the assassination plot would be discovered. The resistance itself might be discovered. Miraculously, they managed to hand that case of brandy to someone who handed it to someone who was a double agent, and they managed to get that bomb off the plane without being discovered. A week later, another attempt was made on Hitler's life, and that too failed. Through his role in the Abwehr, Dietrich was not only involved in currying information and providing the Allies with information also about what Hitler was doing, but he was also starting to help get Jews out of the country. In fact, he'd already started with his own sister Sabine and Gerhard Liebholtz. They had left fairly early on, and he'd made sure of that. He'd driven them himself across the border, and they now were living in London. But things were becoming a lot more difficult. The Gestapo was starting to get suspicious of the actions of the Abwehr, and they were starting to pry into their work. Soon the Gestapo noticed some irregularities in foreign currency transactions, and they traced this and worked out that this was perhaps something to do with getting Jews into other parts of Europe. This all led to the arrest of one particular person who was actually a good friend of Bonhoeffer. And the resistance knew that it was only now a matter of time. Because in those Gestapo interrogation prisons, the torture was such that, well, very few people could withstand. And they knew that names would be given. Sure enough, April the 5th, 1943. Bonhoeffer made a phone call to Hans von Dohnanyi's place, and an unfamiliar voice answered the phone. He immediately hung up, and he knew that the arrests were beginning. But he was very calm. He went to his sister's place. She cooked him a large meal. He ate that meal with relish, and then he returned and he put his papers in order. He knew his room and the place that his study, etc., would be searched. And so he destroyed certain papers, he kept certain papers, he even wrote certain papers for the Gestapo's benefit, and also to lead them down the garden path a little bit. And then he waited. And sure enough, a black Mercedes came and took Bonhoeffer away. Now, there's no time to go into all of this, but At that point in Bonhoeffer's life, he was actually engaged. He had met a wonderful, bright young lady by the name of Maria. She was a brilliant mathematician, actually. And, you know, at the point when they met, and both of them had fallen in love with each other, actually Maria's mother, and she only had her mother at that point, Maria's mother was not at all thrilled with the match. You know, for some reason, she didn't feel that marrying a double agent with the Gestapo on his heels in the middle of a war was the most secure option for her young daughter. But thankfully, after a while, she realized that actually it was good, and she actually gave her blessing to the engagement. And as Maria said, you know, she didn't want to convince her mum, but she wanted her mum to really give her blessing, and that's what her mother did. But 3 months later, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was arrested, and now Maria was alone. She actually didn't know where he was. In fact, no one really knew. But of course, she and the Bonhoeffer family, they had contacts, and they managed to work out that he was in Tegel prison. And soon Maria became such a support to Bonhoeffer during his time in prison. They exchanged letters, she visited him. And also she actually moved in with his parents. She did some work for the father, Karl Bonhoeffer, but also she was a wonderful support to the Bonhoeffer family as well. Tegel prison wasn't as bad as the Gestapo interrogation prisons, but it was still pretty horrific. And this was where Bonhoeffer was being held. He had one thing with him, his Bible. And the strict discipline that he had maintained in all his life, he transferred to prison. Every morning he would spend time in the scripture, meditating, praying. And he had a very strict ritual and a routine, I should say. And soon the guards actually realized that they had a very high-profile prisoner in their midst. And so they gave him some privileges, more letters, a bit more correspondence. And Dietrich took great advantage of that. And he wrote prolifically, wrote to his family, to Maria, wrote to other many other people around, encouraging the brethren. At this point, the resistance, the Abwehr resistance, knew that their plots had not been discovered. The Gestapo still didn't know. And the arrests that had occurred were due to those irregularities and the fact that they knew that Jews had been helped through the Abwehr. But nothing yet had been discovered. And so all of the resistance who were scattered in prisons had this strong hope that very, very soon Hitler would be dead and all of them would be released and the war would be over. They actually used codes to communicate, and the Bonhoeffer family was very well set up for this. You know, they would be able to borrow books, and family members would bring books, and they would have a code where they had some sort of formula that would start at the back, and there would be a dot under one particular letter on one particular page, and then you go a certain number of pages and there'd be another dot. And in that way they could string together maybe one sentence throughout a whole book. And in using these codes, they managed to know what the Gestapo did know and what they didn't know. And also they managed to get news from outside. They also knew what had been asked by other people, by the Gestapo to various members. Even in prison, Bonhoeffer was able to be a pastor. He actually encouraged a lot of the guards. And, you know, they would joke that he almost had a Bible school at the prison, the Tegel curriculum, they called it. And he was counselling, praying for people. And on top of that, he was so busy reading, writing. His letters to Maria were full of such optimism and hope. They talked about their life together afterwards, even their plans for their honeymoon. But on his 38th birthday, Bonhoeffer received a code in a book. And the code said that the Gestapo had taken over the Abwehr, and General Canaris, the head of this secret resistance, had been stood down. The assassination plot at this point had to be passed onto fresh hands. And Dietrich knew that an attempt on Hitler's life would have to be made very, very soon. In fact, there was a sense of optimism that any moment now they would be free. And things were in motion. A man by the name of Count Stauffenberg, he was the one now in charge. He was due to meet with Hitler and some of the key people, and he, in his briefcase, was going to hide a bomb. Everything was planned perfectly. Stauffenberg arrived at the location. He was invited in. He brought in his briefcase. He had a moment to himself where he detonated it. He knew it had about 10 minutes. He placed the briefcase under the table where Hitler was gathered with all his men. And then he excused himself and he walked out with about 3 minutes to spare. He tried to control himself, not to run from the building. And as he turned around, he heard this huge explosion, blue flame leaping out the windows of this home where they were meeting, this military kind of headquarters. And he saw that the ceiling collapsed and he heard the cries. And amidst the carnage, you know, the ceiling of that room had collapsed. The great oak table where all the generals and Hitler himself had been sat around was in splinters. The glass was broken. People lay dead, wounded. There was fire. But Hitler himself had not even been injured. Now, it was simply something like the unusual placement of that briefcase. Somebody may have moved it. And the central oak leg of that table had in some way protected Hitler. Now, Hitler took this as providence. He believed that the fates had made it so that he was preserved, so he could continue his work. But that night, the resistance members in and out of prison, they heard on the radio that Hitler, vowing in no uncertain terms, to hunt down anyone and everyone who was part of that assassination plot. Many of the resistance members took their own lives. They feared that under interrogation they would reveal too much and put other people at risk. Soon enough, Bonhoeffer, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Hans von Dohnanyi, and the other members of the resistance were now moved to a Gestapo interrogation prison. We don't know much about this time. But we do know from other people who went to the same prison that for many, this place was described as the gates of hell. And we have glimpses there were some people who wrote a little bit from meeting Dietrich. And we also know that, you know, the wardens, many of them were won over by Dietrich, even in this hellish place of the Gestapo interrogation prison. You know, they referred to him as this pure, noble soul. They saw such peace in him, so much so that many of them described him as, you know, when he steps out of his cell, he's like a country squire, you know, stepping out of his manor house, so peaceful and calm. It's like he's not in this horrible place. But despite the fact that he continued to encourage his fellow prisoners, he would write notes and on scraps of paper, verses to be passed from cell to cell. Despite all of this, Bonhoeffer really did struggle during this time. And we know this because he wrote some poetry. And he wrote about just the fear and the loneliness. And also the idea of how was he meant to live? Who was he? You know, he knew how people saw him and the comments that people made, the peace that he had. But there were times when he didn't feel that. There were times when he was very afraid. He wrote a poem called Who Am I? And in this poem, he talks about how other people see him and how he sees himself and the confusion and how he really feels. The last lines of this poem. Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine. At this point, the Allied air raids had begun on Berlin. And soon, the Gestapo prison itself had been bombed, and all the prisoners had to be transferred to concentration camps. Bonhoeffer was transferred to Buchenwald. And, you know, at this point, the prisoners were hanging on. They were starved, freezing. But they were hanging on because they could hear the American guns. They could hear that even though they knew nothing of what was going on in the outside world, they knew that the war was coming to its end. And they had hope that soon they would be free, that the Americans would walk in and everyone would be released. Now, Dietrich was now with a whole lot of other prisoners, fairly high-profile prisoners, you know, British intelligence officers, Russians, etc. And he was bundled up with a couple of them. There was probably about 16, and they were transferred to another place to be held. And here we have some information, because one of the British intelligence officers, Captain Best, he actually wrote about his meeting with Bonhoeffer. It was Sunday morning after Easter, and they were all together. They were actually being held in just an old building in this remote village of Flossenburg at this point. And here they gathered together, and they knew that Bonhoeffer was a pastor of some sort. So they asked him to speak to them. And he did. He read from 1 Peter chapter 1. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you." And this is the text that he spoke on. And for Captain Best, he wrote that Bonhoeffer spoke to our hearts. He finished praying, and the door was unbolted, and two plainclothes Gestapo officers came in, calling for prisoner Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer and all the others knew what this meant. It was definitely goodbye. He asked Captain Best to remember him to his good friend Bishop Bell in London. And then he drew this captain aside and he said to him, "This is the end. For me, the beginning of life." By specific order of Adolf Hitler himself, at sunrise the next morning, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was sentenced to execution. He was led to the gallows, and a doctor who was working there watched as this man, this good man, knelt to pray fervently to God for the last time. He mounted the steps of the gallows, completely composed. And the doctor, who at this point had no idea who Bonhoeffer even was, he actually wrote, and he said, "I have hardly ever seen a man so entirely submissive to the will of God." The rope was placed around Dietrich Bonhoeffer's neck, and in the next moment, he was with his God, the God who had served with all his being. He was 39 years old. 3 weeks later, Hitler killed himself. And a week after that, the war in Europe was over. 3 weeks. Many would look on this and feel the tragedy, the death of this man just moments before the end of the war. You know, in Flossenburg, they could hear the American guns. Why? Why was he taken right at the end? But Bonhoeffer, I don't think, would see this as any sort of tragedy. For him, it was a privilege to give everything to Christ. He lived an authentic life, totally faithful to his calling. He used his God-given gifts and the immense privileges he had to make a stand against the massive compromises of the churches at that time, to make a stand for God's people, the Jewish people, and to stand side by side with fellow believers, encouraging them, discipling them, ensuring that they had a strong foundation in the truth of the gospel. I want to finish with something that Bonhoeffer himself wrote, but more importantly, something that he really lived. Costly grace is the gospel, which must be sought again and again and again. The gift which must be asked for, the door at which a man must knock. Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow. And it is grace because it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. It is costly because it costs a man his life. And it is grace because it gives a man his only true life. Above all, it is costly because it cost God the life of his Son. You were bought at a price. And what has cost God so much cannot be cheap for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
I actually chose that song because I feel that in that song, in the lyrics there's so many little reflections and themes from Bonhoeffer's life, things that stood out to me particularly, like the fact that he was so alert and he stood against compromise and that he actually found life in serving the Lord. And I also think that line, you know, to live for him who died for me, you know, that in some ways speaks of that costly grace. So please join us for some virtual morning tea after this. So see you there.